Company.
May it please the Court. As I introduce myself, my name is Rachel Riso, and I represent Shelter. Mr. Waters has one thing correct. There is confusion. But the one thing that's crystal clear is that UIM coverage is a matter of contract. And looking at Shelter's UIM endorsement, it is unique and distinctly different than any of the endorsements the Court has already reviewed. It is clear and unambiguous as to the set-off and the coverage provided, and it should be upheld. The first thing that makes Shelter's UIM endorsement so unique is the introductory note. I don't know of any other policy in the insurance industry that has the introductory note. The introductory note actually explains to an insured how they are to purchase the underinsured motorist coverage. The insured is specifically told to purchase coverage with a monetary limit. The amount they want to insure is the minimum amount they receive from all sources. So the first thing the UIM coverage is a protection of the minimum amount they will receive from all sources. And the respondents received that protection. In actuality, they received greater than 8 times that protection that was afforded them under their policy. The second part is the insuring agreement in Shelter's UIM endorsement. The insuring agreement in the UIM endorsement immediately alerts the insureds that the policy limits could be reduced based upon the provisions in the limits of liability section and the insurance with other companies, specifically amounts received from the tortfeasors under the limits of liability section. As observed by Judge Ahuja from the Western District, who reviewed this exact UIM endorsement, Shelter has highlighted the coverage limitations in its policy and provided clarity, including the introductory note. Shelter's insureds are notified of the possibility of a reduction for the onset. Now, it appears that respondents are attempting to broaden the standard of the rules of construction. The policy is not to be approached as that of an ordinary insured, being that an ordinary insured most likely is not going to read the policy. That's not the way we approach the review of this. The rule applies to review the policy, and if an ambiguity is in fact found, then to approach that ambiguity by that of an ordinary insured and resolve those ambiguities in favor of the insured. We cannot start with the premise that we must review a policy based upon the assumption that an insured is never going to read it. Respondents concede in their brief that the insureds are instructed to carefully read their policy, carefully read it, including the policy's forms, the declarations, and the endorsements to make sure it's the type of coverages that you need in the amounts requested. Now, respondents spent a lot of time on the illusory argument. This has been an argument that's threaded its way through many cases. It's a flawed argument for 2 reasons. First, this is a protection that is afforded. The first thing that UIM coverage provides is that protection in the minimum amount from all sources. And the Swadleys were afforded that protection. The second is the full amount can be paid out. There are situations, albeit not as common, where the full amount of the policy could be paid out.
And what is that, since it's underinsured motorist coverage?
Your Honor, if just looking at Hill, the case in Hill, where the maximum amount of the insured was exhausted on one insured and not the other. And the individual claimant tried to go after the second insured, tried to make them into an uninsured motorist because the policy limits had been exhausted. And the court said, no, there's coverage. The limits are no longer there. So they are still they're still an insured individual. And the court even says this, now had the claimant had underinsured coverage as opposed to uninsured coverage, she could make a claim, but she couldn't in that scenario. So in the scenario where the coverage is exhausted on less than all of the claimants or less than all of the insureds, that insured could go to Shelter if they have not received compensation and would be entitled to the full amount of the underinsured motorist liability coverage. There's a lot of talk about the declarations page. First of all, as we've stated, the declarations page cannot give. So the declarations cannot be the basis for a give and take type scenario. The coverage in the declarations page provides the limit, and then the insured is obligated to read the remainder of the policy. So the insuring agreement is what actually gives coverage to the insured in this case. And if the insuring agreement is read by the insured, it specifically advises the insured of these reductions. The introductory note, or I'm sorry, the insuring agreement specifically says that they will pay subject to. Right there, it's underlined, and it tells the insured of a reduction, subject to. All the provisions of this policy, including those stated below in the sections headed limits of our liability and insurance with other companies. Mm-hmm. And this is where the underinsured motorist definition is inserted. In this case, this is not an underinsured motorist. The tortfeasor in this case was a truck driver. He had $1 million single policy limit in this case. When you take the definition in Shelter's policy and you insert it into the insuring agreement, this is not a case where underinsured motorist coverage applies, because the underlying tortfeasor was not an underinsured motor vehicle. Additionally, as the court addressed on the issue of reading the contract and putting additional things on the declarations page, I had actually put finance agreements, credit card agreements, on my list of documents that consumers are held to the terms of the agreements, and they have not been absolved of those requirements based upon the assumption that nobody's going to read those. The credit card applications are fine print, little font, back and front of a long page. Shelter has taken every step possible to direct the insured by capitalizing, by underscoring, by adding the introductory note that no other policy has. The introductory note is very significant. It has not been reviewed or it has not been used by any other insurance company. And it specifically advised the insured that this coverage provides a monetary benefit that supplements. So right there we have the word supplements that advises the insured that this is not to be determined as excess coverage, but it supplements the coverage. The amount paid to an insured when he or she sustains a covered bodily injury. And then in underscore, it is important to note that the sections headed limits of our liability and insurance with other companies reduces the total limits provided under this endorsement by the amount paid to the insured by persons who caused the injury or paid under another insurance policy. And then further states.
Opposing counsel argues that that's made ambiguous by a provision in the general, page 5 of the general agreement. On insurance coverage, I think it's called, it says your duty to make sure your coverages are correct. You agree to check the declarations each time you receive one to see that all coverages you've requested are included. The limit of our liability for those coverages is the amount you requested. And if you notify us if within 10 days when you receive the declarations if you believe they're incorrect. If you do not notify us, we presume your policy meets your requirements. And they're saying that told them to look at the declarations page to determine how much the coverage was.
You do have to look at the declarations page for the cover limits. But the declaration page does not determine what Shelter is going to pay. That's the insuring agreement. So yes, you absolutely, in our policy, have to look to the declarations page to first determine the amount of coverage, because it's used for two reasons under the UIM coverage. First, the protection that you're asking for is the minimum amount you receive from all sources. And second, the amount in an exhaustion case that you would receive from a Shelter for the underinsured. So that is a part to look at, but that does not absolve the insured from reading the entire policy and reviewing the endorsement.
Well, they don't say it does, but they're saying that it directs them inconsistently. And that creates an ambiguity, which if it does direct them inconsistently, our prior cases uniformly say that creates an ambiguity.
Well, there is no ambiguity in the declarations page. That is the source to find the number. That's the source to find the limits of the coverage. But to determine how that coverage applies, the insured must read the endorsement. The final part of the introductory note after the underscored is you should, and this is what's so novel about Shelter's policy, is Shelter is advising the insured of what they're purchasing, how they should purchase it. You should, therefore, purchase this coverage with a monetary limit in the amount you want to insure is the minimum amount available from all sources to compensate an insured for his or her injuries sustained in an auto accident. And that's exactly what the Swadleys had going into that accident. They just had an underinsured or a tortfeasor with $1 million limits, so it wasn't an underinsured motorist. I spent a lot of time, respondents do, on the offset argument, but offset has, one, never been ruled to be absolutely not usable. It's, if it's clear and unambiguous, the offset can apply. And the statutes have looked at this and contemplated the offset when they determined that you had to have twice the minimum limits. The purpose of that statute was so that if you only had 25, you couldn't offset 25. That would be illusory. Mm-hmm. And that's why the court said, well, if you only have 25, we're going to make it 50. Mm-hmm. And if you, so that it's excess. Well, they're determining a difference between excess and the what we have here in this situation, which is what Mr. Waters explained as gap coverage, but it supplements the coverage. So the court did contemplate situations in where the offset could apply if the language was clear and unambiguous, as it is in this case. I have nothing further, Chairman, unless there's any additional questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Certainly.
Your Honors, my name is Lauren Peterson, and I'm representing the Swadleys, who are the respondents and the insureds in this case. And this case is about whether or not the language of this Shelter policy is written such that Shelter is allowed to sell this underinsured motorist coverage that it will never have to pay in full, ever. And in this case, that it says it will never have to pay anything at all. There's no disagreement between the parties that the Swadleys sustained sufficient damages that would entitle them to the full $100,000 worth of underinsurance that's shown on the declarations page. But according to Shelter, the Swadleys are not entitled to anything in this case because, number one, the definition of underinsured motor vehicle operates so that there's no underinsurance at all in this case. And two, that even if there were, that the setoff would reduce their recovery to zero such that they would have no recovery under the policy. And I want to respond initially to the argument that Shelter raised in the reply brief, which was raised in some lower court briefing about the policy, that this is not an illusory policy, that it could actually be paid in full. As Justice Stith pointed out, that is contrary to the case law that has come out of this court that has recognized that underinsurance is unique because something will always have been received from the tortfeasor. I think that's stated in the Jones case, that this court recognizes that you're always going to have received something such that the limits are never going to be reached with the setoff. With respect to the Hill case, that case does not do anything to advance Shelter's position that this is not an illusory policy. In that case, the claimant, she didn't have any underinsured motorist coverage. She hadn't purchased it, so I understand why she was trying to recover under uninsured. However, she had already collected $100,000 from one of the tortfeasors in that case. So under this Shelter policy, she would be subject to the offset. So there would be no recovery for her under this policy. As the offset, the offset states, the amount stated in the declarations is reduced by the amount paid by all who are legally liable to be insured for bodily injury. So the Hill case doesn't advance the argument that this is not an illusory policy, and I think that that's just disingenuous to argue that the limits could be paid out. And finally, I think this court has said that the policy has to be interpreted in such a way that would be understood by the ordinary insured before an injury occurs. And I think that the scenario that Shelter puts forward, that some other carrier had settled a claim with all these claimants and had left someone out in the cold, I think that that one is not within the purview of the ordinary insured when purchasing underinsured motorist coverage, that this is the only situation that you're going to be possibly entitled to collect the limits of that policy.
Can you address the argument that our prior cases have indicated you can't just create a conflict by looking at the declarations page and comparing it to the limits of liability page? There has to be something else that creates the ambiguity, the confusion, the misdirection. And if so, what is it in this policy?
Sure. I think and I think that comes back around, too, to the Floyd Tunnel case, which both owners and shelter have relied on. And, I mean, I think it's clear that the case law has said that, you know, the declarations are a starting point. I have a lot to say about that. I think number one is that this policy, shelter is the master of its own policy. It writes its policy. And I point out in my brief that there are multiple places within the policy itself that shelter refers the insured back to the declarations page as the place to look for the limits of the coverage under the policy. And I think the reason that the insureds in this case and in the prior case are placing so much importance on the declarations page is because shelter's own policy does that. And I'll just briefly go through a few. The policy defines the declarations as the part of the policy that sets out many of the individual facts related to your policy, including the dollar limit of various coverages. I mean, that's simply not the case. That's not the limit of coverage because the $100,000 is never going to be reached. The index states, the declarations show the named insured, additional listed insureds, policy period, types of coverage, and the amount of insurance that you have. Again, that's not correct. General agreements on which insuring agreements are based. It tells the insured they agree to check the declarations each time they receive one to make sure that all the coverages you requested are included in the policy and the limit of our liability for each of those coverages is the amount you requested. There's the premium payment section where it says shelter promises to insure you based on your promise to pay all premiums when due. If you pay the premiums when due, this policy provides the insurance coverages in the amount shown in the declarations. And that's simply not the case due to the offset. Even the heading of the endorsement says, you know, it's shown, this following coverage is provided only if it's shown in the declarations. And has a little heading there, which I think was discussed in the Bashir's case as being creating ambiguity, where it references the endorsement number for the underinsured motorist endorsement. And it says the limits of liability are the same as coverage A limits, which again are the limits for bodily injury, but again are not the limits due to the offset. I also think that the limit of liability is problematical and ambiguous in this because I go back to the Jones case where Jones said that even though the limit of liability is subject to the setoff, this court suggested that the ambiguity had to be resolved by incorporating the setoff language into the same subsection that contains the promise to pay. And if you look at the limit of liability here, it tells the insured that the limit shown for each person is the limit of our liability for the claim of any one insured. And so, and again, they want to put the setoff later in a later subsection, but even that was the same case in Jones. And Jones said, no, you can't do that. It has to be contained in the subsection that has the promise to pay. And I know that the Jones case used this is the most we will pay, but there was no requirement there that it has to say this is the most we will pay. I think if there's any language that conveys to the reasonable, to an ordinary insured, that it will pay up to the amount shown on the declarations page, that's ambiguous if it won't. You know, the Floyd Tunnel case, I mean, I know that's been cited a lot by both of the insurance companies, but Floyd Tunnel, it was an uninsured case, and what I keep coming back to there is that the vehicles that they were trying to get the full amount of coverage on, they weren't even covered by that policy. They were two vehicles that weren't even listed on the declarations page. So I think that that's very different from this case, where there's no disagreement that the vehicle that Angie Swadley was driving was listed on the declarations page. It was the only vehicle listed on the declarations page. So I think the Floyd Tunnel case was a step-down provision on an owned vehicle, and I think there was a good reason for that discussion about this, hey, the declarations page are, you know, introductory only, because they were trying to get the full amount of UM coverage on two vehicles that were not even listed on the declarations page. So I think Floyd Tunnel is very different from this case. Just briefly, the other thing I want to come back to in this case, so I think, like I said, one of the ambiguities arises because of the declarations page and the import that that shelter's policy places on the page. And then again, the setoff, which ensures that those limits are never going to be paid. The other issue that I think a few cases very recently to come out of the Eastern District have addressed is this definition of the underinsured motor vehicle and how that creates an additional ambiguity.
If the declarations page is in essence what you think really creates the ambiguity here, how could shelter have done it any better, any different? Or if we accept your argument, are we encouraging policies with no declaration page?
Well, I think that's a good question. And honestly, I think you can start by just putting it on the deck page that this is gap coverage or subject to a setoff in the endorsement. I think that's pretty easily done. I think there may be policies out there that do that already. But I think the insurance company puts the deductible, puts on the deck page. I think it's very easy to put a setoff on the deck page. But the other problem, I think, is that I know Shelter wants to talk about how they've revised their endorsement in light of the holdings of this court. Well, I think the problem is that they haven't revised the rest of their policy as well. So I think they need to eliminate all these parts of the policy that keep saying, oh, you have the coverage that's shown in the declarations, when you really don't have the coverage that's shown in the declarations, because that's confusing.
Are there any other states that require the deck page to show to include limitations?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. I just don't know. But
wouldn't that be important if no other states have found that policyholders are misled by not including all the limitations on the deck sheet?
I think that would be important, but I don't necessarily know that we're saying it's just misleading because not all of the limitations are stated on the deck page. I think it's this other language, again, within the policy that refers you back to the deck page, and again, like the limits of liability that says the deck page shows the limit that you have.
I didn't hear you saying it has to reference each limit, too, but simply say subject to the limits set out in the policy.
Right.
So that you know that's not actually the limit.
Some kind of alert, right, or even just some alert that it's gap insurance, because I don't think that is, I think some sort of alert that you need to look for these limitations or the setoff within the endorsement. But like I say, I think the Simmons case and the Nationwide case, which very recently came out of the Eastern District, have held that the definition of underinsured motor vehicle that we have in this case, which defines an underinsured motor vehicle as one who has less insurance than you have in underinsured motorist coverage on your policy, that they have found those definitions to create an additional ambiguity as well, because not only were there other parts of the policy that one promised to pay the amount shown on the declaration, but then there were parts that promised to pay the amount shown on the declaration minus the setoff. Whereas with this definition, the coverage would be eliminated entirely.
Can you address the separate argument that we're not dealing with an uninsured motor vehicle, underinsured motor vehicle here at all, because the tortfeasor had liability limits higher than the underinsured you have here?
Sure, Your Honor. And I think that argument has been raised, has been addressed before in prior case law, even by this court in SEEK, which involves ambiguity found in the excess insurance clause. But I think the case law clearly says that it doesn't stop at the definition, that we have to look at the rest of the terms of the policy to determine whether or not there's any ambiguity. And I think the SEEK case is the one that comes to mind from this court. Simmons, Nationwide, Miller, a lot of appeals court cases that have had the same definition, but they've said, no, we have to look at the rest of the policy as well. And I think that's why the setoff is so important in this case, because the setoff is at least our main argument for why the policy is ambiguous, and thus, you know, the definition of UIM, the analysis doesn't end there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are no further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. First, with regards to the Jones case that she referenced and that Jones talked about incorporating in the promise to the set-off language and the promise to pay, Shelter has gone above and beyond that. In Jones, we were looking at the first time the insured learned of any kind of set-off or reduction within the limits of liability. That's not the case in this policy. Shelter's endorsement starts with the introductory note and advises the insured of a possible reduction. Then it goes.
Can you address her argument that you've added in a bunch of clarifying language, but you haven't taken out the old references that direct the person to go back and look at the declaration, so the ambiguity is still there?
But the insured still has to look at the declarations. The declaration gives those coverage limits, but it does not absolve the insured from the requirement to read the contract and the insuring agreement to see how those limits are going to be
so
paid.
So how is the insured to know when they look at the coverage limits, because it says go look at the declarations page, tell us if we're giving you the coverage you need. How are you to know that unless you know about the limits of liability and that you're not really getting that you'll never receive the amount listed on the
Well, I respectfully
page.
Disagree, Your Honor. You can get that amount in a case where it's exhausted. If you look at the case...
Let's not get off on this. I mean, we've addressed this in prior cases. I want you to go ahead and speak to the main issues. I wasn't trying to get back into Hill. But go ahead.
Well, but that kind of is the main argument, that it can be paid. The amount can be paid, and so when the insured looks back, there's two purposes for that amount listed on the declarations page. It's first that protection that they've paid for. That's the minimum amount that they will receive from all sources. So first is that protection. And second, it can be paid out. The court, just a quick reference to the court in Reinhart, Shelter was found in bad faith for not exhausting the policy limits on two claimants. Because they held back money for that third claimant, Shelter was found in bad faith. So the policy limits can be exhausted on less than all of the claimants in the case. And if that happens, then the full amount of the limits is available in an underinsured motorist case. So in the Jones case with the setoff, we do it in the introductory note, and we do it again in the insuring agreement, and then in the third time under the limits of liability. So these cases where we're looking at, hey, you need to notify them in the limits of liability, we did. But we did it two times before that, and no other policy has done that. When we talk about putting it on the deck page, this is only one limitation within the policy. Within the endorsement, the policies, there's limitations, there's reductions, there's exclusions, and to cherry pick one to stick on the deck page cannot absolve the insured from that continued obligation to read the policy as a whole. And the declarations page gives them those coverage limits, and then the insuring agreement explains to them how that coverage is going to be paid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Again, well argued.